And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Adrian Silbucci from Argentina. We are getting an update from South America, and we're talking about the larger picture of the development of a global government and a global servitude as well, of what the tactics are, and of course, how to avoid some of these. So I wanted to return a little bit more and talk about the protests, basically, and what we've been seeing in the last few years now, because I think you're dead on when it comes to being, you know, inherently suspicious, if you will, of the of these different revolutions that we've seen around the world, like the different springs, you know, Arab Spring, and we've had, I mean, I have my big question marks about the Occupy movement over in the States as well, and you know, these protests are, although they're, I mean, perfectly understandable because of what's going on in the world, I see that this is being used, you know, in Arab countries, in Europe, in Asia, South America now, also then in America with the Occupy movement, as I said, but that this is basically the new normal. I see kind of a level of perpetual violence on the streets, clashes between people and the police who ultimately, you know, protect the government and the whole institution of what is going. So if, again, we're back to that point, Adrian, if this just kind of continues and carries on, how do you think that this will change the landscape, and how, what are we looking at in the future of just this kind of perpetual, you know, urban warfare like the Pentagon and DARPA has been planning now for years? Or what are we looking at?
Well, it is already changing the landscape dramatically and for the worse, because in a way, when you look at, it's the same, as you were just saying, it's the same scene over and over again in the streets of Europe or the streets of the Americas or elsewhere. It's poor people, generally people who have either lost their jobs or lost their livelihood or feel very much at risk because they have no health care. Millionaires don't go out to the street on rampages. Let's face it. Millionaires do not go out and make mass demonstrations. It's always the poor working people, or even the not-so-poor, the middle class, who have seen their lifestyles are so eroded,
yep,
and they see such dark clouds in the future that they figure, well, I got to do something about this, otherwise I'll be the next one that's going to be living under a bridge or something.
Sure.
And yep, it's always that scene of people on the streets, and another group of poor people, because they are poor, called policemen, who are repressing them.
Yep.
So in a way, this works so well that they have managed to have the poor clobber the poor, because it always happens that somebody insults a policeman insults back, somebody throws a rock at the policeman, and when you see that rocks are being thrown at you, well, then you start firing tear gas and rubber bullets, and there's always somebody who unfortunately ends up lying dead on the street, no matter where. So it's the poor people fighting and clobbering and even killing each other, whilst the very rich people, I always imagine them sitting on the 60th or 70th floor of the boardroom of some major bank or major corporation, looking down on that terrible scene down in the street and just laughing as they smoke their cigars,
yeah,
and have their whiskey.
Perfect.
So
you know,
it works. You see, these people are perversely brilliant. It works. We have to know that. And what does Egypt and Argentina and Brazil and Cyprus and Greece and Italy and Spain and even Wall Street, what do they have in common? That all these social phenomenon, erode the sovereignty of the nation,
yep,
state, and
yep,
make people believe less and less that it is a viable option. And what you need to implement world government is for a transition that is taking an awfully long time, for a transition from national sovereign states that will willingly cede their power to a coming global or world authority. Now, the problem is that that world authority that they are designing is not going to be a sovereign one. It's not going to be a democratic one. I mean, it's not going to be a world election anytime soon so that we can all choose the president of the world or some such fantasy as that. It is basically going to be a coercive system, a coercive entity that will be able to impose its laws upon everybody, but controlled from the background through private entities. You see, that's the main problem that they have today. Power has been privatized. We know that power today lies not, for example, in America. Real power is not in Washington. Real power is in New York. And real power is behind the scenes in private entities. Well, you know, it's a conglomerate of the mega banks and the mega corporations and the multimedia and so forth. But private power has one problem. It cannot impose its will upon you. I mean, McDonald's and Ford Motor Company and Goldman Sachs cannot come and knock on my door and say, you must do this, because I can just kick them right out. So they need to have a public power like the American government or the Argentine government that will say, you either pay your taxes or I'll put you, or I'll arrest you and throw you in jail. You either do this or you're going to end up in jail. You have to do this. It's coercive. You must do it. That's why they still need to have a public entity, which will, for now they're national public entities, but in the future will be a global power, a public entity that will be able to impose its will upon everybody and which everybody will willingly accept. Because let's face it, the people of Sweden or the people of the United States or the people of Argentina willingly accept to follow laws, willingly accept that the state has the power to throw you in jail or to levy taxes on you. So they still need to have that. They've worked for many, many generations to get people to accept that. So they still have to maintain that intact. And what they're working on is to erect a world government that will be able, that they will be able to control and use to do their bidding for them. I mean, we have a prime example with the banking crisis in America. It worked so well that the taxpayer ended up bailing out all the banks.
Yeah.
And in Cyprus, it worked so, so well that they are even able to literally just keep the money of their account holders.
It's amazing. Yeah. And I mean, obviously, at that stage, you just have to realize that people, again, people are the ones who are supporting these systems. They just have to pull out their money from these, you know, wicked banks and ultimately stop supporting the government that are freezing these accounts in these banks. And basically they're seizing people's wealth. And it, I mean, in Cyprus, it wasn't really a matter of how much you had really. It was just like everyone's accounts were you know, their money was stolen and frozen basically. It's unbelievable.
Well, yeah, it all, you know, I saw one of the signs where we've seen it in different parts, which is basically very, very simple. Just say no. And there's a lot more to that than those three words would have you believe, because, again, I like to go back to the, since we're talking about psychological warfare and Hollywood being one of the main powerhouses of global psychological warfare, very often you have a lot of very interesting messages going both ways in their movies. You remember the Devil's Advocate with Al Pacino? And
sure.
There's one part where the devil, Al Pacino, tells Keanu Reeves, listen, go back to your wife. She needs you. She's very ill. And the guy thinks for a while and he says, no, I want to finish this case. And the devil looks back and says, okay, you're choosing. In other words, you are given the, you have the free will to say yes, and you have the free will to say no, which is why I insist Faust is such a wonderful work of art from the 19th century, because what does Mephistopheles, the devil, want you to do? He needs you to sign your agreement, in the case of Faust, with your own blood,
yeah,
because they need you to voluntarily sign a contract. Nobody will sign a contract unless he does so voluntarily. So they need you to literally put your voluntary signature and say, yes, I will do it. I will obey if you make me famous, make me rich, whatever. And the whole system works on that way. Everybody has a choice. Everybody has his own free will. Just about everybody, unless you're in a very extreme situation. But just about everybody in the Western world, whether in Europe, in America, or here in Argentina, we have a free choice to just say no. And probably the real secret lies there, and it helps to explain why their psychological warfare powerhouses make such strenuous efforts to ensure that people will not say no, that although they will grumble and they will hate it, but whether it's out of cowardice or out of fear, that people will continue to obey. As long as they continue to obey, even if you don't like it, it's all fine, it's all okay.
So the failure, if you will, that we've seen in society has been sanctioned. When the conditions are worsened, we see the radicalization of regular people, I guess you could say, or, you know, lower to middle class, basically. And then that genuine anger is used, that genuine frustration is used to create an unstable society. And when a situation like this is sustained for a longer period, a lot of people will eventually get tired of this and demand a solution. And this is, at this stage, I think that something is going to be, you know, offered. I think we've seen the same with the economic collapse and everything else, that this is now slowly being reformed. And I think that, you know, down the line, what we're looking here is a global situation, a kind of an Agenda 21 state or something like that, where there will be safety and security perhaps being the number one offered kind of, you know, available choice that people want to go for, but they don't really care how restrictive that's, you know, that state might be or something like that. I don't know. I just, that's what I see when I see all these, you know, these demonstrators and everything out in the streets. But at the same time, then, Adrian, I mean, I understand their frustration and anger, and it's the real deal. But the basic bottom line here is that we still have people, when they're out on the streets and protesting their governments or whatever, you still have people that are going to the same people demanding solutions from those who have actually created these worst conditions to begin with. Should they just kind of pack up and walk away from there, step away from it, and go do their own thing, if you will? Or how do you see the solution out of that situation?
Well, I think that's where guys like you and me and so many others come in, because what we need is a paradigm shift. In other words, trying time and again to solve a problem with a solution that doesn't work is absolute madness. And it seems that people try time and again to solve the same problem with a new face using the same old system, and they have the leading edge, so they can easily control us. They know that people will take to the streets and start major protests and demonstrations, but if they can somehow seize control of that and channel it in the direction that they want, they will still have their own victory, the global power masses, at the end of the day, because people reach a point where they really get very confused and they get very frustrated. And this has been said now for generations, that they will try to lead the whole world into such turmoil, such violence, such unhappiness and frustration, that people will say, oh, will somebody please come and clean this mess up? And then they will have the magical solution. They probably already have it pretty much prepared, but the time has not come yet, so they're not going to introduce it, because things need to get much, much worse. And when they do, they will say, okay, for example, the dollar has collapsed, the euro has fractured into a million pieces, but don't worry, we have a new global currency in store for you. Okay, the government of the United States is corruption-ridden, the government of the European Union is corruption-ridden, I won't even talk about Argentina and Brazil, who are completely corrupt, but don't worry, let's do away with that system, and we can now introduce world government. So in a way, I personally believe that they've had the quote-unquote solution ready for many, many decades, but they know that the time is not ripe yet. It has to get much, much worse. And it will get much, much worse as long as people do not make the necessary paradigm shift to understand that this is a basic model. You see, when you understand that something is a model has an internal logic. You know what makes it tick. And when you know what makes it tick, models have something, when you understand them, which is wonderful, they become predictable.
Yeah.
If I do not know how an engine works, I will just think, well, look, I start up my car and there's a noise down there. I've told them it has horsepower, so there must be a lot of little horses. But when you speak to an engineer and he tells you, no, I'll explain to you exactly how the internal combustion engine works, and at the end of the day you say, oh, now I get it. With that, oh, now I get it, is when the whole thing becomes predictable and it becomes useful. So that in a way, they keep everybody. Look at what the media do. They keep us fully informed. We have never been so informed about so many things and so many places and so many people at the same time, but they will not give you understanding. So what you try to do, what I try to do, is to tell people, look, don't get cluttered with too much information. Otherwise, you go into data overdrive. Start understanding what's really happening. And in order to understand things, you have to take a little bit, you know, step back a little bit and take historical perspective. And that's what they don't want you to do. They don't want you to take historical perspective. They don't want you to think outside the box. They don't want you to think outside the left, center, right paradigm. They want to convince you that there is no other system except for democracy that will work. Yeah. And they want you to believe that this is democracy when it is not.
Exactly. And so people are stupid for falling for it, but obviously it's difficult for a lot of people who don't have this capability of going outside of that. But ultimately, again, people are the ones who are supporting this model, as you said, Adrian, to make sure that things progress as usual. How do you think that, I mean, I think we see small incremental steps in terms of what would be introduced, I guess, on the global scene specifically, to offer solutions. Personally, I've been keeping an eye on something called the Nordic model for the longest time, which is this kind of economic supermodel that, you know, the Economist magazine and all these other, you know, globalist publications have been promoting for actually many, many years now as being the fix, if you will, for global recession and everything else. But what do you see in terms of what will be offered as a solution? And have you seen any of these things being offered yet? Or are we still kind of, you know, X amounts of years away from that?
Well, yes, I think we are seeing them already in the making, so to speak. Even going back to my own homeland here in Argentina has, in many of these things, been a test testing ground of what later, on a small scale obviously, of what later happened on a large scale. Our economic collapse from 12, 13 years ago actually in 2000, 2001 was just a small version of what we later saw in 2008. Argentina's collapse because of the burden of its public debt, and other Latin American countries too. We're now seeing it in Greece, Italy, Spain, well, just about every country, even in America, although they will not tackle, they have the liberty of not having to tackle with their public debt. But if they really had to, America would collapse overnight. And in a way, I think that it will have a lot to do, at least one of the main triggers will be the monetary thing, which we were mentioning just a few minutes ago. The dollar is earmarked to disappear, and the euro is earmarked to disappear for different reasons. But they will be using that to, A, generate huge hardship for everybody, and then come up and offer the magical solution, so to speak. And the fact that people are not seeing it is probably what's going to make it work for them. The dollar, we all know, has been not inflated. It's been hyperinflated. You can call hyperinflation quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3. You can give it any other euphemistic name you want, but the dollar is hyperinflated right now. However, nobody talks about it. It's like the emperor's invisible gown. Nobody will talk about it. So if nobody talks about it, everybody makes believe it doesn't, that there's no problem. And the euro, although it's not hyperinflated because it's a very young and relatively technically correct currency, it runs the risk of being so weak politically that it will just fracture. It will just split up into, well, Germany going back to its currency, France and Greece and everybody else, and the euro can disappear overnight because it just splits up into a whole lot of things. And they know that they can trigger that whenever they want. All you need is for the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal to say, hey, everybody, we just realized that the dollar is hyperinflated and it's going to go down the drain, and it'll be like a run on any bank. People will just start getting rid of it, but then they will have the magical solution. But don't worry, we have something new in store. From Basel, we're going to issue a global currency, and it's going to be a mix of the Federal Reserve plus the Bank of England plus the European Central Bank or whatnot, and they will have the magical solution. The important thing is for people not to fall for it, because it will still be subject to fractional lending in the service of all the private banks, and the private banks will still be in power. Even worse, on a global scale, on an openly global scale, whilst today, although there is a global banking cartel, they still need to operate through national monetary systems. Even the European Union has a semi or a supranational a monetary system. So, you know, if anything, they are upgrading their system more and more. We have to be very careful of that. And the sole antidote is to become aware of the problem, aware of the model, and start seeing that when you mention these things or when I mention these things, it's not just some conspiracy kook saying, oh, it's, you know, they want to take over the government. It's merely the model being projected into the future, into its very likely evolution and outcomes.
Very good. Now, I wanted to mention as well for listeners who are not aware of that already, I talked about it in the past, but you said, Argentina being a testing ground. And in Sweden, actually, in the early 90s, we had a collapse of the housing market, bank failure. We had bank bailouts and everything that was consequent in the U.S. and many other countries, you know, around 07, 08, as you said. Inflation, money was pumped into the system, and the few safety mechanisms that was there in place to stop this runaway train basically was removed just by three people, basically from the head of our central bank and the finance minister and one more who I forget right now. They made it all happen. It was planned, and consequent interviews with these guys has shown that they just ended up blaming each other, and this was a way for them to reform the economic system of Sweden like never before. And there's so many parallels of what happened, I guess, as well in Argentina then, but also in the U.S. now, consequently. So you notice that there is a pattern, and that's being followed. And I wanted to switch as well a little bit to Venezuela, because you brought it up before. We had Hugo Chavez died here earlier this year, and I believe we have Nicolas Maduro coming in as well and taking over after this. What do you make of Venezuela? What do you make of Hugo Chavez overall, what he did there, and what's going to happen with the country now, Adrian?
Well, the country will probably has become much calmer from a regional point of view. Venezuela internally is having a very tough time because Chavez started out as a nationalist. He was a military officer, as a nationalist leader. he had some pretty good ideas regarding, you know, limiting the power of banks, limiting the power of the United States specifically in throughout the region, what they call their backyard, standing up to Colombia, which has been basically an American military base for decades now. But unfortunately, at some point around 2004, 2005 especially, when he suffered a military coup orchestrated by Washington, what had been a more anti-capitalist and anti-Marxist focus on his government, he started to lean to the left, not only because of any specific reason other than that he just couldn't think of anywhere else to go. In a way, he was coaxed into that. So he moved towards Cuba, and he moved towards more left-leaning regimes, which is not a bad thing, except for the fact that economically they failed. Let's face it, the Soviet Union failed economically. Their economic system failed. However, culturally, even ideologically, they were extremely successful. If anything, today the world's ideology, social democracy, is basically Marxist, and a lot of people think and act like Marxists. They're internationalists, they're atheists, they're materialists, they're egalitarian in a rather excessive way, which are all concepts of Marxist ideology. What really did not work is the economic system, and that's where Chavez ran into a lot of trouble. However, he had one specific thing, which is probably the greatest power that anybody can have. He had personal charisma, huge personal charisma, not just inside of Venezuela, but throughout the region. People listened to everything he had to say in Argentina, throughout the region, throughout the Spanish-speaking world. He was very good. He generated a lot of empathy with his people. This is a guy who would talk to, I don't know, a million people and start singing with them local songs. He had a lot of charisma. So that was good, and it was so good, and he would openly accuse the United States of being hypocritical, of being imperialistic, of shoving things down Latin America's throats. He would really speak with no qualms, and that really upset Washington enormously. When he died, and that's why Venezuela was very much earmarked, I think, for being the first victim of Latin American Spring, but he died. And when he died, Nicolas Maduro, who is quite good. He formed himself next to Hugo Chavez for something like two decades, but he is nowhere near as charismatic, as intelligent, I would even say, or as powerful as Chavez had become in the last two or three years. So in a way, Venezuela overnight has become a not so much of a problem for the global power elite. If anything, Hendrik, one of the problems of all these charismatic leaders is that they have such huge egos that they don't really prepare a proper succession.
Yeah.
So when they die, that's it. And I'm not saying that the Bolivarian Revolution is ended, but it definitely has lost 70% or 80% of its punch, which was Hugo Chavez, and he did not prepare a proper succession line, so to speak. So if anything, the Latin American problem for the global power elite now centers on Brazil, on how to control Brazil and ensure that Brazil is brought under the fold. The fact that Brazil cozied up so much to Russia, Russia and China, basically, especially in political, in very sensitive political problems like the Middle East and armaments and so forth, and oil, huge oil reserves have been found on the continental shelf off Rio de Janeiro, and the Brazilians know that very well, and they're exploiting that, and they've beefed up their navy to ensure that nobody meddles around there. So that is a problem for the Americans. Anything that will loosen their grip on oil is a problem for the UK, and it's a problem for the US.
Well, we kind of have this, the enemy of my enemy is my friend scenario, I think, with Chavez as well. I mean, just because Chavez managed to criticize the US in the way he did the US government, he gains a lot of point in people's eyes. They love him for it. When, if you ask me, it's like, well, anyone, the child who has their eyes open would, you know, say what he said and point this out. At the end of it, as I look at it, it's still a socialist dictatorship. Chavez, I think, called it socialism of the 21st century. It's kind of a, you know, as you said, they were kind of, you were trying to lean away, I think, a little bit from the Marxist-Leninist socialism. But at the same time, when he talked about this, he argued that, you know, he wanted to have a more of a, you know, he said like this, let me read this. He used this new term to contrast the democratic socialism which he wanted to promote in Latin America from the Marxist-Leninist socialism that had been spread by socialist states like the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China during the 20th century, arguing that the latter had not been truly democratic, suffering from a lack of participatory democracy and an excessively authoritarian governmental structure. I'm sorry, but I mean, we're talking about the biggest mass murdering political ideology in the history of mankind so far, with the Soviet Union and Russia. And to say that it's just suffering from a lack of participatory democracy, I don't know. I don't agree with that at all. I think it's very unfortunate that he's trying to romanticize a political system and an ideology in such a way, because he's, you know, this is what he's talking about is a, I don't know, a brother and sister kind of system to one of these, you know, most mass murdering political ideologies in the world. So I personally, I don't understand why he gained so much, you know, credit in people's lives. But I guess, is it just because it's that simple? He managed to criticize the U.S. and people are like, yeah, you go. what do you think? Why is he so popular?
I couldn't agree more with everything you just said. The problem is that from the point of view of Latin America, let's go backwards now to the Cold War era. The Soviet Union was exactly as you described it, and you Europeans had it so close by that you know better than anybody else. And we knew that too. People who were aware in throughout South America knew that too. But the other enemy, the United States, was so much closer, and it made its grip felt so much harder that, if anything, we said, there is the real enemy. And Chavez very shrewdly used that. He knows that throughout Latin America, for everything we have suffered from the Soviet Union, from the Soviet era days, we've suffered 20 things from the States, with the added disadvantage that the Soviet Union went in 1989, 1990, and that the United States is still there, and it's still imposing government, it's still overthrowing government, it's still doing all the financial mischief you can possibly imagine. You know, I'm going to be very cautious about what I'm saying now, because being an Argentinian, you will say, well, this guy is, you know, has an axe to grind. But we had one good leader from the Cold War years, who was Juan Perón. Now, he made a lot of mistakes. Every government will make a lot of mistakes. But there was one thing ideologically that was quite good. He tried to find an arm's length relationship, both from the United States and from the Soviet Union. And a very simplistic way of expressing this was when he made these mass rallies in Buenos Aires. I'm talking about the 40s and the 50s. The rallying call was, no Yanks, no Marxists, just Peronists, which was a way of saying Argentina does not want to have anything to do with the Americans, not just from the ideological point of view, with liberal capitalism, with capitalist democracy. We don't want to have anything to do with the Marxist regimes in the Soviet Union and China. We just want to do our own thing in our own style. Because you see, one of the problems with capitalism and one of the problems with Marxism is that they impose standardization. It's like Hillary Clinton said back in March 2012, that was last year, yeah. She went to visit Egypt when it was still in that, even before Morsi, when it was still in all the turmoil, and Mubarak, I think, had just been ousted. And when they asked her, what's the purpose of your visit to the Middle East? And she said, in the case of Egypt, we want to make sure that Egypt has the kind of democracy that we want to see.
Right. Yeah.
And there's a lot of meaning in that phrase, because democracy, what goes under the term of democracy, which is absolutely hypocritical, there's no democracy whatsoever, is the kind of democracy that the global power elite want to see so that they can impose their candidates. So they will not tolerate anybody saying, no, we want to do something different. We want to do something in our own style. I mean, the Swedes have your own style, Argentinians have our own style, and even the Americans have our own style. And there's no reason why it has to be fully standardized for everybody.
Yeah, one size fits all, yeah.
Exactly. Well, the Marxist system emanating from the Soviet Union had a one-size-fits-all, and the same thing with America. So in a way, that is part of the problem. And Chavez very shrewdly used the fact that everybody knows that the greater danger throughout our region has definitely been the United States and Britain. From the point of view of Argentina, for example, we were at war with the United States and Britain, but we were never at war with the former Soviet Union. If you ask the same question now to a Hungarian or a Pole who was literally invaded by the Soviet Union, he would say, well, I see it differently, because I had these guys in my country taking it over for 40, 50 years. So, you know, it all depends on how tight the shoe fits on your foot, so to speak. But yes, I think that Chavez, when he had the chance to leap forwards into the 21st century, he merely looked back into the ideological paradigms of the 20th century, and that in a way buried his political chances for good, because they just don't work. okay, he had a lot of sympathies with a lot of the left-wingers throughout Latin America, and there's millions of them, but it was not something that would really look into the future, that will solve the problems of the future, because the problems of today cannot be solved, neither by Marxism, definitely, nor by liberal democracy.
Yeah, I think personally, I mean, we've talked on the program about anarcho-capitalism, which is a really good option of free market capitalism. That still enables you a tremendous amount of more individual freedom that any version of socialism does. And I mean, if we are contrasting this as well to, again, what the enemy is of you know, Venezuela and so forth, I think that the neocons and all that, that's about imperialism and exportation of, you know, quote-unquote democracy, which is, you know, not really true democracy, of course, it's just rhetoric again. But the neocons, I mean, they have erroneously, in my opinion, become representative of capitalism. They're more corporate fascist. They want to impose another restrictive system upon people, which is not about anything to do with free market or individual freedom in any regard. So I think that all of these systems are fighting with each other, and people are, for the sake of simplifying, they are taking one of the sides just because they're so fearful of their enemy, instead of just stepping away from that game altogether and thinking, wait a minute, under what system, if there's any system that should be there at all, would enable me to have more freedom as an individual? That's what I think the bigger question is that people should ask themselves.
Well, there you go, and you've just really hit the nail on the head, because it all goes back, in a way, what you've just said so perfectly, to what we were discussing some minutes ago. It all boils down to how aware people are. Let me put it this way. Right now, Argentina has had the level of education and culture of our people has fallen dramatically, not just because of the Kirchners, but over the past 40 years, because of successive bad governments, because of too much American television, because of all these crises that have really made people bite the dust and be so concerned with just surviving that they've had no time to really think about these lofty things that we are speaking about right now.
Yeah.
In a country like Sweden, I've never been to your beautiful country, but I imagine, or the sensation one gets is that people, it's a much more stable society. People have a better educational level. you have a longer history. So in a way, it all boils down to how people even internalize values. That's why I was saying before that values, traditional values, I'm not talking about anything religious. I'm just talking about the honesty, the value of being hardworking, loyalty, fighting corruption, not tolerating corruption, etc. Those are the things that will keep a society going. In a society like Argentina, people have become too not just naive, but even negative. They're saying, okay, all politicians steal, so we're just going to have to live with that. And you figure, well, no, wait a second, you can't live with somebody who you know is going to steal from your public funds from the moment that he's been elected or she's been elected.
Yeah.
So these things have a lot to do with the actual culture, and I fully agree with you. There are ways of putting, you speak about the Nordic system, which I'm not familiar with, but I can from hearing you.
Look it up, Adrian. Look at some of the stuff that's been coming out of from like The Economist and some other places. They call it the next supermodel. Even if you search on that term in Economist, you'll be able to read about it. And it's tremendous amounts of propaganda coming out. The majority of this is coming out from a think tank out of Dubai that were previously in London, called the Legatum Group. And they've just, I mean, I ran this down recently in one of our commentaries that we did about this, but it's basically a system which is, it offers you the illusion of some kind of economic freedom, while it really actually stifles the population in overtaxation and just, wide privatization of everything. So, it's a perfect system for those who would seek to control a population. And that's the reason why it's being exported. And people should ask themselves, when these people from the Legatum Group, the think tank, have their roots in neocons, they're supportive of being like the people are involved in the Aspen Institute that's been going back and forth. There's like a number of connections you can make there. And people have to ask themselves, wait a minute, if this is for openness and democracy and a fair economic system and all this, why do you have people who are, you know, coming out from the neocon world basically and advocating a system like this? So it's just, to me, it's very obvious, but people are still kind of duped by thinking that it's, you know, a more fair system and something like that. It's very strange to me.
Yeah, I very much see your point, and it all goes back again to what we can do, what each of us can do to investigate these things, understand these things, and then put out the necessary antidote so that people will, A, not fall for the false traps, and B, continue working towards what should be the economic and political system and monetary system, especially the monetary system, because people don't understand the functions of money, for the 21st century or the 22nd century. We have to really, it's a terrible stage in the history of mankind, because we cannot fall back on old things. We can fall back on the things of the past when it comes to values, as we were just saying a few minutes ago, honesty, integrity, and so forth. But when it comes to what will be the best economic, financial, and monetary system of the future, we literally have to create something new. One of the things that we're putting a lot of emphasis on, and I think it ties in with what you were just saying here, is that people, and nobody teaches you this at university, nor do they mention it in the specialized media, that there is a major difference between public currency and private currency. The banks create private currency out of nothing and charge interest on it. And yet public currency, which has been so completely defiled, distorted, and completely thrown out of all proportion, and yet there lies probably one of the key issues that has to be brought back into balance. The fact that a central bank in a sovereign nation that issues its sovereign currency, that currency of itself cannot reproduce itself through compound interest, because it just can't. It cannot do it. However, the volume of money, the velocity of money, which is something that can be calculated, has been completely thrown out of all proportion, so that you have no chance almost of having any country satisfy its internal needs with its own currency. They need to fall back into the monetary system controlled by the global power elite. I use the following example down here. I always tell our people, say you have to build a highway from, I don't know, Buenos Aires to some other city. The territory is obviously in Argentina. The cement is produced in Argentina. The steel is produced in Argentina. The workers that need work are all available in Argentina, ready to work. Why do we have to go ask the World Bank for a credit in dollars? That then you have to pay interest on it, and they will tell you, okay, if I want to give you the credit, you're going to import the cement from America, you're going to import the steel from somewhere else, and all the workers, I'm going to tell you with what insurance company to insure the whole thing with. And what would have been worth $100 million will end up being worth $200 million. So, you know, people have to, in a way, use the logic without falling into, because public currency has very bad press coverage, because governments have become so indisciplined that they just issue money as they need it. And yet the function of a truly sovereign nation state is to issue the amount of money that the real economy needs. In other words, that the real economy producing things, people who do things like produce cars or bake bread, something that will amplify and expand the economy. If you just issue money to pay, I don't know, for foreign debt or whatever, well, obviously that's going to be inflationary. And that's what's happening in Argentina. They're printing all the money that the government needs to buy up the dollars to pay for the foreign debt. So the bankers get their dollars and we get inflation. It works perfect.
Yeah. And this organization does not have any boots on the ground, so to speak. The bigger and the more centralized a system like this gets, you know, like the World Trade Organization that you're talking about, that are regulating these things on a massive scale, they end up losing touch with what is needed, if you will. And I mean, it shouldn't even be really on such a central level as a nation state. It should be more local, I think, to be able to have run currencies efficiently, so that you realize what is needed at that time, and the communication on those levels is so much more quicker. The more you go up the hierarchy to the top of the pyramid, it becomes increasingly stupid, I would say, as well, because intelligence actually just falls off at that point, and even if they make a decision, it takes years for it to be implemented, Adrian. So this is another problem as well. The bigger something grows, the more just disorganized it gets.
Well, look at the European Union. I mean, listen to any of those massive 400, 500 delegate discussions, they are complete chaos, and they are a complete lack of understanding and even of creativity. You know, one of the questions that we ask here, and which often triggers a lot of people's minds starting to tick, is what is the amount of currency that a country needs? I don't know, but I don't know any specific case, but it definitely can be calculated, because Argentina has 40 million people, and we definitely need one specific amount of pesos, which will be different from the United States that has 300 million people. Yeah. It's got to be something different. We have a large territory. Uruguay has a small territory, or Sweden has a small territory. Our automobile and construction industry is so big. In another country, it might be different. The velocity of the circulation is one set of characteristics. characteristics and geographically in one country, a different one in another. I don't know the number, but I do know that it can be calculated. So why don't we start by calculating the exact amount of currency that the real economy needs in each country, according to each country's characteristics, demographics, geographics, and so forth, and start working from there. And what is the benefit of that? That if you start getting that formula right, you start to need less bank loans, private bank loans, and there lies the secret, because the banks want to lend you money. I call it down here the Shylock effect, from the miser Shylock from Merchant of Venice. Shylock right. didn't want the Antonio to pay back the 3,000 ducats. He wanted the pound of flesh. So all these mega bankers, when they lend huge trillions of dollars to all nation states, they don't want the money back.
Right.
They want to use that as an excuse to impose state reforms, impose specific politicians, and impose all the things that they're imposing, not just in Argentina, but in every country in the world.
Take control. That's the ultimate objective and the goal here. Take control of the nations, and then eventually you can reform it as you see, and you can slowly nudge it in the direction that you want it to. And if this continues, let's say then, Adrian, let's kind of look ahead a little bit here. How do you think that things will be developing in the future? I mean, there are movies that are kind of depicting some of this. It's like people can watch like Rollerball or even Soylent Green or something like that, where there's like these massive corporate structures in place that have, to a certain extent, replaced the nation states. You have sectors in big cities and very, very divided between an upper elite that takes care of everything and then basically everyone else. And that's kind of where if it is allowed to continue, that's kind of where it seems like it's heading. What do you think?
Yeah, well, we are definitely standing at a dividing point, at a fork on the road of humanity, because from now on, when I say from now on, I'm thinking in historical terms, now being the next 10 or 15 years, but from now on, everything will depend on what we do or don't do as mankind, whether we will be able to move forward and progress at least at to some level, or whether we might really fall back into a dark age of a sort. Because I mean, a world government the way these people want will be your worst nightmare, like George Orwell used to say, a kicking a face permanently all the time. I think he mentions a phrase like that in 1984, or as we know, the former Soviet Union was throughout the Soviet Empire, both in Asia and in Europe. So it all depends on how aware people become to know when to fight back. You know, I remember there's a part, I can't quite remember, I can't even quote it, but I can at least describe it, that Alexander Solzhenitsyn mentions in the Gulag Archipelago, where he said that at the worst stage, one of the worst times of Stalinism in the 30s, he was living in Leningrad, and people were terrified every night, because they would hear two or three cars stopping, and they would hear people coming, some agents coming in, and they walked up the stairs, and all of a sudden they said, oh no, they went to pick up the guy on the third floor, or the guy on the fifth floor. Thank God it's not me, and they would all go back to sleep. Yeah. And he said, and then later we learned that it was only about 3,000 or 4,000 agents coming out every night that terrorized a city of 3 million people. All that we had to do was get together some of the men, start terrorizing these guys, start really beating them up so that they would be scared to go out into the streets, and all of Leningrad would have slept well night after night. So very often their amounts are very tiny, but they're well organized, and they have the powers to instill fear. Nowadays, they don't instill fear in America, for example, or in Britain, saying, hey, we're going to go after you, we're going to kill you. But they instill fear that you might lose your job, that you might lose your home, that you might lose your livelihood, etc., 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 which is just another form of fear that might, in the long run, make people accept anything, world government, world currency, anything, as long as, you know, like Howard Beale says in the movie Network, just let me stay in my living room and let me get on with my life, that's all.
Yeah.
That's basically all people are asking for. Nobody asked for anything really exceptional.
Yeah, they want to be left in the safety zone, if you will, as well. They don't want to, you know, step outside of that comfort box, although that box is diminishing and getting smaller and smaller all the time, and eventually will be so small that you won't have anything left. And you know, what are you going to do then? I mean, so what you're talking about here is different versions of psychological terrorism, if you will, that's been ongoing throughout history. And I think that to a certain degree, although it's not as, you know, as you explain, as so physically challenging, if we can say, as it was during the Soviet era, it's a more of a mental terrorism or psychological right now, Adrian.
It's a moral challenge, and if we go back to, we were speaking during the program, to the basic values that they want to destroy in us, one of the values with which we can all fight back is called courage. In other words, when you realize that something means risk, it even means the risk of death, it means that you might have to suffer, but that the option of losing everything is so much worse that you're willing to have the courage to go and do whatever is necessary to be done at the time. Yeah, yeah. Naturally, it's much more complex. In days of yore, when there were wars, well, you just picked up your musket and you went and fought for your country or your neighborhood or your family or your country or whatever. Now it's much more complex, because if I were to ask you, who is the enemy? Even that is a difficult question.
Yeah.
When the Americans were a colony, when America was a colony, the 13 original colonies, and you asked them, well, who's the enemy? The Redcoats. Very simple. Yeah. In Argentina, the same thing. Who's the enemy? Spain. Very easy. In World War II, depending on which country you were in, you knew who the enemy was. But nowadays, as an Argentinian, or as a Swede, or as an American, or as a Brit, who is the enemy? You can't say, oh, the enemy is, I don't know, another country. You can't say the enemies are a specific ethnic group, because it just doesn't work like that anymore. It's far more complex. So what they've been able to do is to reduce extremely complex problems into binary good and bad, black or white. And again, in that psychological warfare, Hollywood has its splendid work of destruction, because they are always putting all the problems into black and white. The FBI are the good guys, the crooks are the bad guys. The Germans were the bad guys, the Americans were the good guys. So, you know, they're always harping around that basic binary, non-holistic way of approaching problems. And if anything, if we are really to survive and if we are really to overcome all these problems, it's got to be in a much more holistic and being able to come to terms and grasp extremely complex problems. And as you well know, extremely complex problems seldom can be boiled down to good or bad, black or white, binary, one or two.
Very good. Courage. Good point. And to dare take risks instead of just clinging on to the diminishing comfort zone that we mentioned before, because otherwise soon enough it'll be all taken away from you and you'll find yourself in a completely different situation. I think that's a good overall positive message to leave people with for this time, Adrian. Thank you so much for coming back with us. Great having you back, by the way. Very enlightening, and we really appreciate your perspective and sharing it with us. Why don't you, again, if there's anything else you want to give out, of course, about something you have upcoming or your website where people can go to find more about your work, and you do have some book titles as well still. Are those still for sale on your website, Adrian?
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. If anything, if anybody who's been listening to us, and I really want to thank you enormously, Henry, for having me on the show again. It's been most enjoyable, and really talking to you is very refreshing, intellectually and morally refreshing. So I'm really extremely appreciative of that.
Thank you.
If anybody who's been listening so far wants, even aside from visiting my website, www.asalbucci.com.ar, I would also be delighted to receive any emails. My personal email is arsalbucci, that's arsalbucci, @gmail.com. And I'll be delighted to answer any comments or any thoughts. And I do have a book which is called The Coming World Government, Tragedy and Hope. In a way, it's a sort of a way of honoring Mr. Carroll there, who also had a similar book by that title. And it's available. It's not on a printed basis, but it's available for anybody who wants to see a copy through the internet. So I'll just be delighted to send it off to anybody who asks.
Excellent. asalbucci.com.ar. And then you have, of course, Coming World Government, Tragedy and Hope there as well, available on the website. Thank you so much, Adrian. Let's stay in contact and let's touch base again. We'd love to have you back at some point here.
My pleasure, and thank you very much indeed.
And as we begin to round up for today, I just want to let you know that when we'll return in just a few days, we'll do so with Graham Hancock on his historical novel, War God. Then we have Ken Rolla on Ormesite and Scalar technologies used for healing and free energy. Later, Scott Onstott, Suzanne Posel, David Icke, and others coming on. A big thanks to all our members and everyone at Red Ice for keeping the broadcast going. We'll speak to you soon. Take good care. Bye-bye.